That's a good, good song. Written by Canadian songwriter Bruce Cockburn. Performed for us by Steve Bell. Wondering Where the Lions Are. 15 and a half past the hour. It's a Tuesday morning here along the Broken Road, and Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don is a biochemist, a member of the board of Creation Moments, and a delight to have along every Tuesday morning. We talk about things like science and evolution and faith and creation and that sort of stuff. Don, how are you? Good morning.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave. I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, David is doing well today. He had because he left early yesterday, just left me standing here by the microphone.
Oh. he didn't even show up last week.
Well, that's true. There were a couple of days like that. so David, what's up here?
Wait a minute. What? This is about me now all of a sudden? What's the deal with that?
Might as well pick on David for a while here. I think so.
Well, the way I make money here. Mm-hmm. Keep the door open and keep the body fed and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the way I keep the missus, happy, happy. Mm-hmm. She every once in a while, I'll see her and she'll look over at me and she'll just grin. Mm-hmm. I say, oh, yeah. Now we're talking. We like the grinning missus, know? Mm-hmm. And the mystery shopping people, for whatever reason, are just like the rest of us. And I've often said that I do my best work under the light of my burning bridges. Mm-hmm. You wait till the last minute to do something. Mm-hmm. Well, they do too.
Yeah.
so they, and their way of getting things done at the last minute is to give me more money. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work.
They call up David is a mystery shopper. Now, we can't talk about this too loudly because it would blow his cover. So he operates, in fact, On the QT would be a good name for your company that does this.
Ooh. I can see the banner now.
And David visits various places of business around the region, drives lots of miles, and he has this invisibility cloak that he wears. he'll go into like a Costco or a Walmart or a gas station or a fast food place, and he'll leave, and they won't even know he was there.
I picked it up at a Star Trek convention.
Yeah.
It's old Klingon technology. Mm-hmm. Used to cover the whole ship, and I've got one that's a little smaller, just covers me. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's what David does when he's not here. Mm-hmm. And he was doing that yesterday. Don, you and we talk about some pretty thorny subjects, and this may be one of the thorniest, but one of the most understandable things, I think, and it has to do with the Cambrian era, epoch. It's a period of time, isn't it, the Cambrian era?
Well, yes, it's thought to be a period of time, as evidenced by the layers in the rock in the Cambrian layer, or rock layers, is where you'll find most of the fossils. Actually, mm-hmm. you can find fossils from all the major phalum or kinds of animals are represented in this layer.
Well, if we were to draw kind of a picture here, if you can imagine this big drilling ensemble that goes down into the earth and drills down deep and comes up with a core of the earth, a sampling that is a big cylinder. I don't know how many feet tall. Probably how tall do you suppose that would be to get through all the fossil layers? Maybe a couple thousand feet.
Okay. It depends. I'm sure it depends on where you are.
That's the question I've always had about the Cambrian and the Precambrian and all the rest of that stuff back in my olden days as an anthropology undergrad. I mean, it depends upon where you are when that period was, which kind of makes the alligator brain spin around and say, mm-hmm. huh? That makes sense, apparently.
Well, the assumption is the deeper down, the older the animal. But that's not necessarily true either, because the earth throws things up in the air and mountains come up and things change. So I'm oversimplifying it here, David. Mm-hmm. If you imagine this big stone column being withdrawn like a cork out of the earth, and then you look at all the layers in there, how far down would the Cambrian layer be, and would it be a really wide layer? Strata or a narrow one?
Well, there's several layers in the Cambrian layer to begin with, and it would, I'm sure some places it's fairly thick as opposed to other places where it might be thinner, which, you know, I don't want to get to the punchline too early, but, you know, is quite well explained through a creation model, but not well explained, of course, from an evolutionary point of view. But the interesting thing about the Cambrian layer, or the Cambrian period, if you will, is that, one, you find fossils, a lot of different types of fossils in this layer, but the layers below the Cambrian period, you find no fossils.
So there's nothing, nothing starting from the bottom, there's nothing, and all of a sudden, shazam, there's the Cambrian layer, and you're finding a huge, an abundance of different kinds of creatures there.
That's correct. Okay. And so this has caused the evolutionists, or this is a conundrum, let's say, for for the evolutionists, because, you know, if things are evolving from one kind to another kind, as evolution would say, then we should see a gradual different changes, but as you go through the layers from one animal to another animal, let's say, or from from an amoeba all the way up, to man eventually. But you don't find that. What you find is in this Cambrian rock layers is you've got all the different types of fossils and many species that even, you know, don't exist today. And then below that there's absolutely nothing. So how do you get from nothing to everything is the conundrum.
Now, are there fossils before that? So
no.
I mean there's
the
problem. I guess I read the article and I thought it's as if there were fossils found on Monday and Tuesday, and then there was nothing found on Wednesday and Thursday, and then they found fossils again on Friday and Saturday. But you're saying there was no fossils found on Monday and Tuesday either.
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, we have to look a little bit closer about that. But yeah, I believe that the major problem with the fossil record is that you have nothing, or if you have anything, it's very, very, very little. And then all of a sudden you've got this explosion. Well, I actually call it the Cambrian explosion, because that's where all life, at least recorded in the fossil record, is formed. And think the Cambrian period was about 500 million years ago. And this article that we're discussing, which was in the Institute of Creation Research's website, is describing a new method for determining, for trying to, wiggle your way out of the Cambrian explosion, and describe that, okay, yes, life existed before that, and we're going to show you how it existed. So, we're going to look behind the curtain, and we're going to find the answer to this problem. So what they did was to say, aha, let's look at DNA, and let's look at the rate of mutation of DNA. And then, you know, we can, based on the animals that we find in the Cambrian rock, we can then go back and say, well, how far back can you go based on the mutation rate prior to the Cambrian period, and say that, you know, maybe life began. So they did that. Now, the unfortunate thing is with DNA, it doesn't all, it's dependent on where you look within the DNA as to how fast it mutates, because you have regions within the DNA that mutate a lot faster than other regions, and other regions that are quite stable. So you can't just, you know, say, well, you know, we're just going to take an average and go from there. But you have to be fairly specific as to what region of the DNA that you're talking about.
Don't they also have to have a picture of what the original DNA was like? I mean, how would you know when it started to change?
Well, that's a good question. You have to have animals that you have today, I would suppose, and then look at their DNA, because you're not going to find it in a rock, or at least rock remnants of a pre-existing
fossil. Is a true true fossil would not have DNA, would it? I mean, it's just mineral.
Right, exactly. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's been in quote fossilized,
yeah.
the whole process of fossilization is you're exchanging minerals for the tissue that was originally there. So, at any rate, the folks that did this particular study said, well, we're going to set our DNA clock based on the animals that we find in the Cambrian period, and that will give us the ticking rate, if you will, so we can calibrate our rock based on the Cambrian period, and then we'll just let the clock go backwards and see how far back we need to go. And so they did that, and they came up with an answer of 80 million years. So, 800 million years. So, apparently, 800 million years ago, life started.
That was here square one, huh? Okay.
On Earth, although we have absolutely no evidence of that. The only evidence that we have is this, in quote, Cambrian explosion. So, it's an interesting... interesting study in that, if man is bent on a certain type of premise, he's going to search hard and long and stick to his premise regardless of the evidence that you have, today about what's around us. So these folks apparently spent a lot of time doing this and probably a lot of computer effort to generate this model, and they got it published in a reputable journal called Science, and here we are. Well, what's the problem with their model? Well, the problem is that they're first using, as I said before, the DNA doesn't degrade or doesn't mutate at the same rate. For all of the DNA, it's only certain sections that are hyper.
There's one huge assumption. Yeah. Okay.
That there are hot spots, if you will. And second is that they're calibrating against the very thing that they're trying to explain away. So it's, again, an example of kind of circular argument that they're using in order to push the clock back of evolution and help to try to explain where all of these animals came from.
Well, where did they come from? What's a logical explanation for the Cambrian explosion of life, this Cambrian conundrum?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because... in the creation model, of course, we know that all the kinds of animals started, God created the fish and the birds on day five. So all of the flying animals and all of the sea creatures he created on day five. And on day six, he created all the land creatures. So we know that is the starting point, and... we know that at least the young Earth, us young Earth, folks believe that all this happened, 6 at the most 10,000 years ago. And so all the different kinds of animals were formed, back then. Well, what happened? How do you get a fossil? I mean, this is the basic question. How do you get a fossil in the first place? I mean, how do you get, let's say, a whole leaf, whether you're talking about a maple leaf or, some other type of leaf that you find fossilized, or a whole animal or parts of animals completely, encapsulated in these rock layers? Well, you have to entrap them very, very quickly in mud, for example, they have to be the mud has to be kind of deficient in oxygen. Otherwise, you know, this material is going to break down before it has time to fossilize. And third, there has to be a lot of minerals in the water in the mud or the pre-rock material in order for there to be mineral exchange between the animal that has just been buried, let's say, in this mud layer.
And this would explain why fossils are most commonly found in places like layers of shale or sedimentary rock, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do we have a model that would, you know, explain such a thing? Well, we do. It's called, a matter of fact, the Bible talks about it. It is the Great Flood. Or a lot of people call it Noah's flood, but Noah didn't start it. He was just experiencing mm-hmm. the flood. But we've talked about the flood many times on this program before, but it was a period of time where there was catastrophic things going on in the earth. Such things as, the Pangaea, for example, breaking up into the continents that we have today, which would have caused major earthquakes as well as major tidal waves, which, bumping up against the Earth's crust would have formed a lot of sediment and would have laid down a lot of sediment all at one time. So any animal, or human for that matter, that was, living during that period of time and who was not in the ark would have not only got killed, but would have gotten trapped in these tidal waves and these mud waves, if you will, that came. That is an excellent model for what we see geologically, for example. One of the things you asked a question earlier as to, well, you know, how deep is the Cambrian, this Cambrian layer? And I said, well, it depends on where you are. If you're closer to the seashore, it's going to be extremely deep, and it could be, almost, 5,000 feet, the mud layers that we, or the rock layers, sediment layers that we have, even on the coast of Americas, for example, is much deeper on the coast than it is on the inland.
Now, is it the same both east and west coast? Just curious about this. Or is it deeper on the east coast?
That's a good question. I think it's a little deeper on the east coast mm-hmm. than it is on the west coast, but it is deeper on the coast than it is inland, mm-hmm. and which is what you would expect if you had, huge waves crashing in, to these continents that are, many continents. Of course, the Americas, mm-hmm. not so many, but are in the process of breaking apart, and then you've got water splashing and with carrying all kinds of stuff, sea creatures as well as the land creatures being entrapped. And so what you should see when you go dig down into these layers is, animals all scrambled up in a nice, well, okay, here's a herd of buffalo, for example, that just happened to be, mm-hmm. Just happened to die, and for some reason they're buried as a whole herd. Well, mm-hmm. you never find that. What you find is all kinds of animals.
And of course, the article says that most, or it implies at least, that most of the life found in the Cambrian layer is aquatic life, which would jive nicely with this explanation of the flood.
Well, that's correct, mm-hmm. Because you would have a lot of aquatic life being stirred up, obviously, by the flood, and the land animals would be seeking higher ground, if you will, and it would be a little bit harder to trap them. Before the flood, the conditions on Earth were perfect for life, and so you had the dinosaurs who, well, if man lived, to be 900 plus years old, then that meant that the dinosaurs, lived that old as well, and they had all the nutrition that they could want. And so they would just keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And so that's why we got, you know, we got big, big animals, because they didn't die off. You know, things didn't, of course, after, you know, after the fall, the animals were not necessarily just herbivores, for example, just vegetarians. They could have started eating, you know, other animals earlier. I mean, after the fall, as opposed to after the flood, when God actually told Noah that it was okay to start eating animals, certain types of animals. So you would have in the flood model, for example, you would have, as you suggested, that you would have more sea creatures, especially, you know, as you get closer to the coast, you would have more sea creatures in the fossil record. Then as you come inland, you would tend to see an increase in the animals that you're, the other animals.
So that alone suggests that things like tsunamis, tidal waves would have been connected with the formation of these layers, these sediment layers that contain the fossils. I mean, that sounds eminently logical to me.
Well, it is. And we know that, you know, tsunamis form quite nicely, you know, with subterranean earthquakes, for example. And depending on the energy in the earthquake will depend on, you know, how high your tsunami is going to be. So if you're breaking up continents, you can imagine the amount of energy that is being released. And, you know, like the earthquakes that we have today, the earth didn't just, well, okay, I'm just going to rip apart and it's all going to be nice and even. These things happened with you know, large jerks. So, you know, things would be fine for a while and all of a sudden the earth would, you know, split apart and you would get a large jerk and that, therefore a large release of energy. So these tsunamis that we're talking about were probably on the order of, could have been, you know, as high as 800 feet.
My goodness.
Which is hard to imagine today because we, you know, okay, well, we got a 100-foot tsunami, but, you know, 800-foot tsunami, I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, something that large and the devastation that would cause, of course, to everything in its path.
Hmm.
Well, the Cambrian layer is at various depths depending upon what part of the earth you're on, and everywhere there is a Cambrian layer, or could you go to like the middle of the continent and there would be nothing associated with what you find there that would lead you to think it was the Cambrian layer that is comes from that age, and we would say, as young Earth creationists, we would say that was the time of the flood, the just immediately post flood when that happened. Is the Cambrian layer uniform? I guess that's what I'm asking. Uniform across the Earth, except for depth?
Well, you would have...
or only coastlines, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it's, you know, it's completely uniform around the Earth. But as I would say, you know, as I said, the depth of the sediment, you know, varies greatly as you go inland. So whether you're talking about Americas or whether you're talking about, you know, Europe and Asia, as you go inland, then you would have you know, less of a depth to the sediment.
So you would not find, let's say, if you went to Nebraska and dug down to the same depth that you were on the coast. On the coast, you might be seeing Cambrian layer, but in Nebraska, you probably would not see aquatic animals. Would you see a concentration, perhaps, of land animals?
You do see, and more inland, you do have more land animals trapped. Now, you know, the when Mark Armitage, for example, found his Triceratops horn, it was an intact horn. It was not a fossilized horn. Obviously the animal was in a mud layer. And so you do find that more in the inland parts of the continents as you would, you know, as opposed to the fringes of the continent or the near the oceans where you do have, you know, these rock layers and then you have actual fossils being formed. So that would suggest perhaps a different mechanism where maybe the tsunamis didn't reach quite that far, but something later happened, the melting during the Ice Age, which was a post-event to the flood, and we talked about that on a previous program, that when all of that ice, melted or began to melt, then you would have had, more rushing water, and it wouldn't have been quite the event that the tsunamis would have caused immediately post-flood. And, you would have had more animals being buried at that time, but they would have been, like I said, on a surface, more of a surface type of thing, as opposed to buried in multiple layers, because the tsunamis that you had after the flood, I mean, there were multiple tsunamis, and they didn't all happen at one time. They happened over a period, let's say, of maybe 500 to 700 years as the continents were, moving apart. Post glacial period, you would have had areas that were, of course, prior to the glaciers melting, it would have been solid ground. But after the glaciers started melting and the water started rushing off the face of the earth, then you would have had mud and more animals, being trapped in that. And there are pockets within the United States, for example, where you would find, more fossils or more, animals or evidence of animals, of even footprints of animals. And we have that at various places. Mm-hmm. Dinosaur National Park is one example. Those would be more in, layers, mud kind of layers on the surface of the earth, as opposed
Let's take a step back here and look at the big issue. It seems to me that a young earth creationist would read this article and say, well, it's obvious that the existence, we know there is this Cambrian layer, that's prima facie evidence that there was a flood. On the other hand, an evolutionary scientist would say, wait a minute. Maybe we can come up with another explanation. And it looks like they've tried and kind of fallen on their face with this this fossil clock idea. That's measuring the DNA, the rate of change of DNA, and it's taking us back to 800 million years, and it's the circular logic problem that you addressed. Shouldn't it be obvious that the existence, the best explanation for this is a global catastrophe of some kind?
You would think, the only explanation is that man's minds are clouded, mm-hmm. And we, of course, God talks about that in Scripture, that your mind is actually God allows you to think whatever you want to think, and I, for me personally, for example, I was a evolutionist. I believed in evolution. I had the evolutionary story down pat before I became a Christian. And I could tell you everything from the Big Bang and to cosmic evolution to biological evolution. And I said, I thought that was logical. But when I became a Christian and, started... I started from page one, which was, Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and started to read Scripture and started to read commentaries on Genesis. I said, this is the only way it could have possibly happened. So what changed? Well, obviously I was born again. So my spiritual self, came alive, which then through the influence of the Holy Spirit, I was led to the truth. So God allowed me to be clouded, to have my thinking, clouded prior to that time. And I think that's the major problem. here is one of a spiritual thing and not not necessarily an intellectual thing or a logical thing, because man has the ability to make sense out of any story that, that you can come up with. And I, you know, I think we see that time and time again. And it only is because of when you finally understand, or at least God allows you, takes the veils. I mean, literally takes the veils off. He took the veils off of my eyes, and allows you to see what's around you for what it is in the light of Scripture. You kind of say, oh, okay, yeah, that explains it, and that's a very good model for this. Mm-hmm. you come up with a different conclusion.
Interesting.
You know, except for here, and you know, I paged down to the bottom of the article. This article was posted in September of last year. So other people have had a chance to discuss it and to kind of pass it around too. Do you suppose, and maybe there are published versions of the discussion back and forth, are others gathering around the old electronic water cooler and saying, oh, this is nonsense, or this doesn't hold water, or this doesn't even hold fossilized water? Are others in the scientific community talking about this as well?
Oh, about which aspect of the article? The
alternative way of aging fossils.
The DNA clock, then.
Yeah. Aging non-existing fossils.
Well, you know, I can't answer that question, but I would presume that you know, most evolutionists would say, "Aha, yeah, okay, well, that explains it." And would go on about their business and not necessarily analyze exactly what was done. Now, the intriguing thing, of course, about any type of DNA analysis is that it's a much more sophisticated method than, you know, just looking at a bunch of fossils. So if you can get computers involved and do DNA analysis, and you know, people would say, ah, that's a more sophisticated model. So obviously it's got to be correct. And I think that's probably the thinking of a lot of folks. And they would say, you know, they would look at that and say, okay, if those smart folks think that stuff started 800 million years ago, then you know, life probably started at that time, and wouldn't necessarily take the time to critically analyze what exactly was done, because first of all, they would say, "Well, I don't understand what was done in the first place," and it's not that complicated. I mean, you can, you know, conceptually, you can say, okay. You know, DNA, we know today that DNA mutates over time. And we you know, like any rate of change, you can use that rate of change to either go forward or to go backward. And, you know, even, you know, us creationists use the DNA clock, if you will, to say, are, you know, the mutations that we're seeing today, what if you would go back in time, what would that get you as far as, let's say, a perfect DNA? Well, if you do that experiment, it turns out to be about, you know, 4,000, 5,000 years. Well, what happened 4,000 or 5,000 years ago? The Great Flood. And so whatever the conditions were before the flood, our DNA wasn't mutating. So, you know, we can use the same type of techniques, but come up with totally different conclusions. And these guys, you know, they tried to set their clocks by the very thing that they're trying to explain. So instead of actually taking, you know, mutation rates that have been published for DNA, they went ahead and took kind of reestablished the rate based on, well, we've got these type of animals in the fossil record, and we know that, okay, that had to mean you know, that the mutate, they, in other words, they lengthened the mutation rate, or they made it much much smaller than the actual rate, knowing different species that we have today and knowing the actual mutation rate. You know, they kind of stretched the clock out, if you will.
They accommodated their theory is what they did.
Yeah, by trying to calibrate mm-hmm. it with this Cambrian explosion.
Mm-hmm. Interesting article. Is the Cambrian explosion problem solved? Article by Brian Thomas. It's available over at the Institute of Creation Research. We will have a link to it on the podcast of this morning's conversation with Dr. Don. That'll be up in an hour or two. And so you can read the article for yourself. Otherwise, you can go to the Institute of Creation Research, which is icr.org, and just search with, you know, put in Cambrian explosion in the search bar, and I'm sure this article will pop up for you. Don, interesting. And if we could isolate the problem, I'm thinking, listening to this conversation and the same tendency on the part of the believers in evolution seem to be present in a lot of areas of science here, and the tendency, as I see it now, is that we do experiments now and we determine certain things and we assume that it always has been the way we see it now. In other words, we see weather change, so we say, aha, this is unusual. This isn't the pattern that we've known all of our lives, all of recorded history, which with weather is like 130 years. I mean, it's no time at all. And we see things, we assume that what we're seeing is the way it always has been. That's not the case. As you have explained here, I mean, there's the flood, there are cataclysmic events in the history of the Earth that changed patterns. And we can't just make those grand assumptions that because we see it this way now, so it has always been.
Well, in the words of Barack the First, many times he's not been asked many times, but he was asked, I think it was last week, he says, hasn't this sort of thing been tried before? And if, I'm not sure exactly what it was specifically about, but haven't these kinds of things, the economic things, been tried before in history and always failed? And his response was, yeah, but I wasn't here then.
Well, and that's, you're right, Jim, that we can't tend to try to explain, you know, past history, for example, on events that are happening exactly today. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, in the social and the political realm, the old adage that, you know, if you don't learn from history, it will repeat itself. And obviously it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's repeating.
Socially, but, politically, in so many ways, yeah. Yeah.
But if you ignore the obvious, you know, in science, especially in geology, if you ignore the obvious cataclysmic events that we have recorded in the geological record, if you will, all around the Earth, if you ignore that and say, well, you know, there weren't catastrophes, or they were just micro catastrophes. This didn't happen. You know, it only happened over here. It didn't happen, you know, over there. Yeah. Then you obviously come up with the wrong conclusions.
Dr. Don Clark, member of the board of Creation Moments, their website, by the way, creationmoments.com. You'll find the huge supply of resources, information, scientific evidence, really, of the young Earth creationist position. And it makes a fascinating couple of hours. You can meander over there to creationmoments.com, take a look what they have to offer. There are books you can buy. There are DVDs. And of course, we feature Ian Taylor's Creation Moments radio program here on the air, too. So it's well worth the time. creationmoments.com. Don, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week. Okay.
All right. Very good. Well, we are busy in the vineyards.
I'll bet.
I bet you are.
Weather pretty nice down there now. Huh? This is vineyard
weather. It's getting up into the 70s and the 80s, which is causing the buds to break, and we haven't finished pruning. So,
okay. Well, we'll let you go out to the field with you, Don. Get out there. Take care.
All right.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.